Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Monday, February 18th, 2020. I am John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary Magazine. With me, as always, senior editor Abe Greenwald. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Associate editor Noah Rothman. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And in Washington, senior writer Christine Rosen. Hi, Christine.
Hi, John.
Tomorrow night, Wednesday night, there will be a debate in Nevada, and Michael Bloomberg will be in the debate, having qualified due to various polls that show him. One poll shows him at 19% in the Democratic field. This candidacy is an interesting test of all kinds of different theories about American politics that have been percolating for the last 20, 30 years, one of them being that money has now come to play such an outsized role that we need to control it. That was the Campaign Finance Act that was largely ruled, much of it was ruled unconstitutional in the Citizens United decision of 2010, I think. But the ongoing theory has been that rich people play a disproportionate role, and that money plays too large a role. We need public financing. We need less spending, not more spending. And we now have a real test case of this in the unlimited resources that Michael Bloomberg is throwing at the Democratic nominating process. So that's one interesting thing. And then the other interesting question is, is his argument that he's the best person to beat Donald Trump because he is arguably the most right-leaning of everybody who is running, is that going to be an interesting test case of the proposition that the Democratic Party has not moved so decisively to the left that the idea of a candidacy that comes at the right from the center rather than from the liberal or liberal left is the way to go. Those of us who live in New York and live through the Bloomberg mayoralty and everything about it have a bunch of other views, I think, about what Bloomberg was like as mayor and as a public figure we can get to in a minute. But Abe, when you look at these numbers and you think about this surge in the polls that Bloomberg has enjoyed.
He's at 19% now, right?
Well, there's one poll that has him at 19. Yeah. He's winning. There are various states where he is, of course, the only person who is advertising or even having a public role where he is. He's apparently tied for the lead in Virginia. He's winning in Oklahoma, you know, stuff like that because he's advertising in Oklahoma and no one else is. So and then in Florida, he's in second or third place or, you know, whatever. But
yep. So, I mean, I think that's exactly right. So there's this sort of urgent fortune that was dumped into advertising for his campaign. So I think the surge is really almost entirely this surge in recognition. I think when he now is having earned his spot under the altered rules, on the debate stage tomorrow, he will my overwhelming suspicion is that he will do a very poor job because he is a bad debater. He's a bad question answerer. I mean, you know, even beyond the sort of the endurance test of the debate, just when he's confronted on, you know, just a plain single question about what you said, I don't know, you know, about policing in New York cities. The answer is, oh well, that was 5 years ago, or whatever. I mean, these are terrible responses. He becomes less likable as he speaks.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, so I should take this up quickly. I was one of the few pretty sour people in New York on Bloomberg throughout his mayoralty. We published a piece in this magazine by Fred Siegel in 2010 called "The Bloomberg Bubble Bursts." Interestingly enough, something that may or may not be happening in the next couple of weeks. His candidacy, his mayoralty was largely given credit by people for, you know, having been a decade or 12 years of prosperity for New York and low crime and all of that. And a lot of us think that basically it was a lot of that was entropic, that these were all the result of him simply maintaining policies that had been put into place with a lot of blood, sweat, and tears during the Giuliani mayoralty that he was smart enough not to interfere with, and that a lot of his own programs, his own initiatives, the effort to build a stadium in a neighborhood called Hudson Yards that is now largely with private money become a sort of a real estate development, the effort to get the 2020 Olympics for New York City, which failed, and then a lot, the redesign of Times Square, which I think is, a lot of people think is good, and I still think is bad. And I think most importantly, the nanny state things that he did that sort of made him both famous and notorious, from, you know, making it impossible for anybody to smoke a cigarette anywhere in the city. Now you can't smoke a cigarette, but the smell of weed permeates the air everywhere. Not that that's his fault, but you know, the banning of large cups for soda, a lot of different things. Where he showed his imperious private, his notion that New York City is sort of like a privately held company like Bloomberg, and that he can sort of, you know, enact his will. And then ultimately the unbelievably undemocratic thing he did, which was to sort of literally bribe people into lifting the term limits law, which was lifted for him so he could run for a third term and get a third term, and then was reimposed. Because, I mean, you know, fascinating bit of governance play with money, which we can also get to in a minute. But I don't think he was a particularly good mayor. He wasn't a terrible mayor. He wasn't a great mayor. Nothing that he wanted to do, you know, as in sort of originating policy, including, by the way, the take over the management of the city schools, which is something that he affected and then basically didn't do much with.
But you know,
a complicated story there. But
can I say that there are a number of New Yorkers, a lot of them, who have this sort of affection for him. They embrace him, and I think what appeals to them about him, and these are usually people who sort of self-described moderates. They have a level of sort of comfortability with him, and I think that is sort of the worst potential quality for anyone else around the country to catch on to, you know, to latch on to.
Right.
Why would anyone else be sort of comfortable with this?
Well, by the way, there are two things about Bloomberg, a very good piece in the New York Times that is like literally 15 years too late, but fine, came out about how Bloomberg manages his political life, which is to say that he uses his private fortune. He makes enormous numbers of politically savvy donations to people to either buy their acquiescence or their silence. He did it throughout his mayoralty, which was bizarrely uncontroversial in a city where every mayor, you know, had activist buzzsaws going at his head every minute from the 1960s onward. And there was weird social peace in New York during the Bloomberg mayoralty. Why? Because he gave his philanthropies gave money to every activist group in New York City and bought their silence. And this New York Times piece relates a story about is it the Center for American Progress that did a report that blamed Bloomberg for something and then on Stop and Frisk and then removed his name from the report because he was a big donor to the group. And that is something that went on in this city with every activist group. So people remember, who lived here, remember this as a time of strange social peace. There was very little kind of friction at the activist level. But that was because he bought people off, not because maybe that's good, you know, fine. So he did what he could do. That's what a lot of those people want. And so he bribed them and they went away and they made life here a lot more pleasant. Christine?
Okay, but I agree, but I think that also actually reveals one of Bloomberg's serious problems here. I was thinking about what you said about him trying to kind of find a middle lane here that Biden in his free fall is losing. But I think that Bloomberg has a very serious problem still from the left flank. And trigger warning for our listeners, I'm about to sound like a radical progressive grad student, but it's race, sex, and class, right? We know he's got the stop and frisk race problem. He has tried to handle that, get out in front of it with these groups of endorsements from African-American leaders, with his apology, et cetera, et cetera. But on the issues of sex and class, he's going to have a much harder time doing that. He's about to have a long, strange trip of post-Me Too era explanations for why early Bloomberg company was like a frat house, all the things he has said himself about women, the non-disclosure agreements that haven't been lifted with women in his company who claimed harassment. So there's a whole bunch of stories that are going to come out about that. And then on the issue of class, I think the billionaire approach, you know, the battle of the billionaires idea of him versus Trump is kind of intriguing. He has a little more leeway there if his main opponent is Sanders, because the millionaire fighting the billionaire, you know, Sanders doesn't have as much credibility as he likes to think as an individual with that. But I do think the sex and class issues are going to dog him, and it'll be really interesting to see if they come up in the debate tomorrow night.
I mean, by the way, the the Me Too thing, this again is an aspect of Bloomberg and his money and the brilliant way that he's used his money, which is to say, Bloomberg's comments and things to women at his business in the 1990s were disgusting. A lot of us knew about them at the time. People didn't write about them very much because he had started this incredibly deep pockets media corporation for which a lot, I hate to say this way because it, you know, but a lot of people wanted to work there or thought at some point they might work for him or have something to do with him. And so a lot of that was kept pretty quiet. There were a couple of pieces about it, and it's a privately held company. So like no one could do stockholder activism against his disgusting comments about women being pregnant and you could just kill the baby so that you would, all kinds of really vile things. Would have killed anybody else, but that because his company was privately held and because people wanted to go work there, because he was paying ungodly amounts of money for columns, for columnists, for news reporters, even as the business was, you know, starting to tank, that's another way that he bought his own piece. And he has never, never really faced the kind of grilling over his personal conduct that almost everybody else in politics not only has now, but would have then too. It's not like we have new consciousness about this. I mean, he abused women verbally at work for you know, 15 years, and then bought them off with non-disclosure agreements. You remember this was a big thing with Trump and the non-disclosure agreements and Stormy Daniels and all this. Bloomberg is one of the founders of the non-disclosure agreement method of buying silence for your misbehavior.
And that's Noah. Part of the problem is that ultimately these sort of things pop when you have a personalized aspect to it, a personal story. And it'll be very difficult to find someone who can give a personal story. You said this is on the record, you have to defend this, and it'll probably stink. I agree with Abe. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to translate into a news cycle, and plus you can bury news cycles. Just about whatever moment happens on the debate stage will probably be buried in the paid media that he's blanketed the country with. So this is going to be a multi-billion-dollar enterprise at the end of the day. And ultimately, it can bury just about any earned media. And it seems like what we're looking at here from the Democratic side is just the same mistake that the super online woke campaign strategists have fallen into just about over the course of this entire campaign, which is to think that his ultimate weakness is on race and how he's not woke enough and how he's, you know, his excessive policing methods are really unpopular among progressives, which they are. But they're not really unpopular among African Americans, for whom crime, violent crime, is a major issue. African Americans say to pollsters that violent crime is a major issue in a way that it is not for Hispanics and definitely whites who do not deal with it on a daily basis. That's part of the reason why Mike Bloomberg was pretty popular among African Americans in New York City and remains pretty popular in this demographic. So I'm not sure that that's the way to get him. The way to get him, he's kind of a monster that progressives have really created. Because the way to get him, to me, is a way that no progressive can make the case, is that he's an absolutely obnoxious, heedless social engineer But they like absolutely obnoxious, right. heedless social engineers, right. people for whom any opposition is deemed extremist.
Well, this is a real test. See, this is my point. Which
and
is
also the, that yeah. The money thing. I mean, how do you eliminate the power of this of billionaires?
Right.
The well, easiest way to do it is to lift individual campaign contribution limits.
Right. That's right. Well, we don't know.
No one will ever do that on the left.
I know, but we don't know now what the effect of his paid media will be as against really skeptical coverage going forward. We don't know. We're going to see.
Well, and he really does, as you all have signaled, and anyone in New York knows, he has an empathy deficit, right? So even if he's able to get out in front of some of these critiques, even if they do come from his progressive left flank and a more hostile media, he's not going to tell those stories well. I think Noah's right. Like, even if you have one sympathetic person telling a story which paints Bloomberg in a bad light, his response is going to be probably almost Trump-like in its perhaps not in its tone or belligerence, but in its inability to connect to the audience that he needs to persuade about his authenticity and his concern and all of the changes he supposedly made since, you know, the 1990s.
Right, without him having a base except among rich people in New York. And I mean that quite literally, that very well-to-do people in New York feel very comfortable toward him. When he ran the city, at some point, somebody pointed out that there, as there is a real affordability crisis living in New York if you're in the middle class. And he said, look, if you have to move out, you have to move out. I mean, New York is a luxury good. And living in New York, you get access to a lot of things. And so this is how the mayor of a city, the largest city in America, 8.5 million people, of whom, a disproportionate number, relatively speaking, are well-to-do, but in which, 5 or 6 million people really aren't well-to-do at all. This is how he deals with the fact that people were having to spend, half of their pre-tax take-home pay in rent, was to poo-poo the fact that it was a problem. I mean, that's not just an empathy deficit. That is a rich person, gross rich person, refusing to understand what anybody who is not flying on private planes is like-ism. And that's really who he is. You can mask it by running written commercials and doing all that. But generally speaking, he's one of these sorts of people who, when he opens his mouth and is not talking about things that are very specific in policy terms, like how to do this or how to run that or how to control spending or how businesses work or stuff like that, will stick his foot in his mouth on an astonishingly regular basis, including mispronouncing people's names and, stuff like that. What he has and what he had was a pretty even, dull demeanor that was, again, after the heat of the city when Rudy was mayor, was a welcome contrast, that he didn't lose his cool, he never lost his temper, he didn't yell at anybody, and he just sort of plodded along.
He's been abandoning that. He's been adopting
When does he yell, though?
No, it's not yelling. It's more like disdain.
That he always had.
It's more combative now than I remember it being, particularly in regards to how he deals with Trump.
But exactly. I mean, I was going to say that the wealth issue, if we end up with Bloomberg versus Trump, will be really interesting because, ironically, Trump's insecurities about his own fortunes and which translates into a kind of boastfulness about how much money he actually has made and a downplaying of his failures and his bankruptcies, that weirdly connects more to regular people than I think that they can connect to that insecurity and that boastfulness in a way that they can't connect to the cool-eyed, rational billionaire who's quite secure in his own fortune, right? I mean, it'll be interesting if they are the two debating wealth on stage.
If there is a benefit to the notion that this could all come down to Bloomberg and Sanders, it would be an illustration of how irreparably broken both the parties are. The 2016, what did the race come down to? A guy who the party hated and a guy who had no relationship with the party whatsoever. What does it come down to in 2020? A guy who the party hates and a guy with only a transactional relationship to the party. You've got
two transactional relationships, right? Because Sanders wasn't even a Democrat until 2015,
right.
And neither was Bloomberg.
Right.
for that matter. So Sanders' transaction was that he was an independent socialist who caucused with the Democrats so that he could do something. And Bloomberg was a Democrat who became a Republican and then became a Democrat again. Well, became a Republican, then he became a no-party person, then he became a Democrat, all in preparation
it's
for this run.
It's cold comfort, but it is some satisfaction to watch, you know, this wing of the party that engage in all this self-flattery about how it couldn't happen to us. We're so pragmatic. We like government. We're invested in just solutions and not ideology. To watch them be, you know, consumed by this disease is a little, you know, well, rather self-assuring.
You know, we should point. This is an interesting thing because in 2015, when Jeb Bush got into the race, part of the thinking was, it can't be this. We can't be this country now, where you have the wife of a former president running against the son and brother, the son of a former president, the brother of a former president. Like, this is the kind, we've become an aristocracy. This is an aristocracy, not a democracy. So Jeb Bush didn't win. Trump came from out of nowhere as an anti-establishment populist guy with no ties to anybody. So now we may be in a position where we have Trump, this, you know, would-be, wannabe billionaire versus a billionaire. And then we're in a, what is that? That's a kleptocracy. It's not a kleptocracy, whatever you would call it.
Oligarchy.
I guess oligarchy. So then, the parties, which existed in a way to prevent this sort of thing from happening and to privilege people who worked in the trenches in politics and give them the leg up for having served the interests of the party and therefore, in theory, the public, that they would be the people who would work and labor and slave through these, you know, public meetings and boring this and campaigning and all this so that they could climb this greasy pole and end up at the summit. That's what parties did. Parties, you know, privileged worker bees over rich guys and dilettantes and feckless sons of more accomplished people. And their decline means that we are now in this kind of potentially decadent condition in which name ID, wealth, and family position are, you're going to need to have one or the other just to start from nothing, you know, start from scratch.
Except in Bernie's case, it doesn't exactly hold. I mean, although he has nothing to do has had nothing to do historically with the party.
No, I'm just saying, if Bloomberg were to win, it would say something.
Oh, I think it holds, it's the same thing, because how have those reforms taken, I mean, what is the practical form in which those reforms take? It is to privilege voters. It is to give voters more control over the process, the people more control over the process, and weaken the institutions. And the effects of that are to have really unsavory candidates who have a lot of popular appeal.
Here we are back to your, we have too much democracy. And there is a real...
just about as anti-populist as you can get.
No, but I'm just saying we are finding ourselves in the grip of a fascinating kind of crisis, because if Bloomberg is the only alternative to Sanders, your choice is between somebody who is literally openly and without shame trying to buy the nomination of a political party in the United States.
People really object to that, by the way. I don't know why.
They
object to the notion that
he's not buying anyone.
How dare you?
He has already spent more money in this race than anybody. I don't mean personally. I mean, no one has spent a third as much winning a going for a party
nomination. He's
already
spent more than Barack Obama's re-election campaign in 2012.
Right, and he has spent more to up to this point.
The general election, not the primary.
Right. He will. It is an open. This is what he is promising. By the way, part of what he's promising is, you elect me, and the spigot will be open. If you give me the, you know, all the delegates from Oklahoma, I will give the Oklahoma Democratic Party $100 million to rebuild itself. If you give me your votes in Nebraska, places where Democrats haven't really had much of a, I mean, Oklahoma actually had a Democratic governor recently, but where you haven't had a strongly functioning Democratic Party, and he's like, the implicit promises, you know, I'm going to walk around and rain money on your head if you just give me what I want. Nothing like this has ever remotely happened before. This is a new paradigm for American politics, and you don't have to be a populist to think that this is really, really bad. I mean, I don't even know what to make. I would think, the whole interesting thing about Trump was that he ran, I'm a billionaire, right? He spent less getting the nomination than anybody else did.
By the way, it's
then Cruz and Rubio and Bush did.
He had a ton of individual contributions.
He himself spent, I think it was $56 million throughout the entire campaign from the primary through the general election. Meg Whitman, who was the CEO of PayPal, spent she spent $150 million losing a Senate race in California.
By the way, it's also particularly disgusting, I think, in Bloomberg's case, because I don't know what else it is that he's selling. That is the core fact of his candidacy.
Yeah, I will buy the presidency away from Trump.
That's his issue.
Yeah,
essentially.
I will spend what it takes to get Trump out of the presidency.
I will say, Bloomberg's defense, that he has had one spectacular success that is an unalloyed good, and that is exposing the extent to which Stacey Abrams doesn't mean a thing that comes out of her mouth and is as nakedly power-hungry as any politician you've ever seen.
That's happened today, point. Right? Stacey Abrams, the failed Democratic candidate for governor in Georgia,
State
who claims
House representative, still has not who has conceded. Her eyes on the presidency and no office in between.
Yes, is apparently going to endorse him on Friday. She gave him he gave her money, and she obviously is trying to stay
current. She's out there saying, well, at least we know where it comes from.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's what makes it valuable. It's not dark money that we can't trace because it's charitable.
On Abe's point, though, I think that there's another way to look at this. I mean, I'm sure you all have seen the bumper stickers and signs around that say any functioning adult 2020, you know, this sort of ironic, you know, just put someone who's an adult in the Oval Office. I mean, in some ways, Bloomberg's throw money at the problem 2020 is a reasonable response to that impulse. I mean, people
clearly
are not, with the exception of the Bernie bros who are, as we now know, all too riled up for their candidate, there hasn't been a lot of enthusiasm for anyone else. It's just get Trump out. And Bloomberg is playing into
that. But that's an indictment of that sentiment, right?
Exactly. I agree.
Okay, let's go to the primary. So here's what happened. Pete Buttigieg has done phenomenally well from nowhere, right? I mean, he basically won or tied in Iowa. He came within a point of winning in New Hampshire. Amy Klobuchar had this surge.
He still leads in the delegates.
Right. Amy Klobuchar had this surge in New Hampshire, got 20% of the vote from nowhere. Bloomberg is spending all this money. And the net effect, if the polls are to be believed, is that he has crashed and burned both the Buttigieg and the Klobuchar candidacies, because Buttigieg in one poll, one of these national polls, is down by 6. Biden's down by 9. Nothing is happening with Klobuchar.
But so, neither of them performed especially well in the states that are about to vote, Nevada and South Carolina.
We don't know that.
The polls, but for their
I know, but the polls in Nevada don't.
Victories.
Yeah, but remember, Klobuchar surged in the final weekend, right? After a really good debate performance, that's apparently what did the trick for her. And Buttigieg, it was his victory in Iowa that helped him, you know, reestablish himself as the not Bernie in New Hampshire. So ordinarily, you would go from here on, and they would be the story, right? I mean, can she keep moving forward? Can Buttigieg establish a beachhead against Sanders, and keep eating Biden's lunch? And now comes Bloomberg, And, you know, it looks like they're dead.
I mean the net
if
effect,
these polls are to be believed, they're dead. And it's all because this one guy walked around spending $400 million.
But they weren't going to go anywhere anyway. Amy Klobuchar had more upside, I think, than Pete Buttigieg. But neither of them had more than... Amy had regional appeal. Pete Buttigieg has no support among minority demographics. And the net effect of a Bloomberg campaign is likely to keep donors' wallets closed. Because
right.
they had nowhere else to go but back to Joe Biden, who suffered a lot and then never really raised a lot of money.
Right.
But if you're contemplating getting in this race now and fighting the Bloomberg money machine, why?
Okay, so here's my point. They may be dead because they didn't move fast enough, and then there was this Super Tuesday buzzsaw of $400 million in spending that will privilege Bloomberg and is apparently having a privileging effect on Bloomberg nationally. This means that it's Sanders versus Bloomberg. So if that's the case, but they'll stay in, like they're not going to disappear. So Sanders is the nominee. I mean, basically Sanders, one of these polls, and again, in a poll today has Sanders at 31%. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, the
Sanders
Maris, NPR Maris poll.
Right. So yeah. The Sanders parallel to Romney is now almost exact, that he is a front runner, but a weak front runner, but he's a front runner. And everything under him is not going to coalesce or congeal into a force that will stop him. Now, the Democratic Party rules are different. Democrats do proportional representation. Republicans largely do winner take all. So you could, as Romney, you could get 35% and end up the nominee, or Trump could be 45% and end up the nominee. That's really not the case, really, with Sanders. But as Noah, you've been saying forever, the logic of the Democratic Party's not one man, one vote philosophy is that if Sanders comes into the convention 250 delegates ahead of his nearest rival, the idea that he can be denied the nomination even if he doesn't have the first ballot is...
Oh, there's this gloriously dramatic Aaron Sorkin fantasy in which this the first ballot of the convention fails because everybody's pledged, and then they're released on the second ballot to vote for whomever their conscience
dictates. And Alan Alda becomes president.
Right, yeah. it'll be very dramatic. No, I mean, we're talking about broken institutions, cowardly... institutions that no longer have any authority that they can wield on their own and dictate terms to the public rather than the other way around. So the idea that on a second ballot at a contested convention, anybody but the delegate leader, no matter what the delegate leader's lead is, walks away with the nomination just strikes me as fantastical. I don't think that's even plausible.
And if it's like this, by the way, you can just put a fork in the Democrats. They're done. I mean, this scenario, Bloomberg's getting into the race and spending $1 billion will be the thing that reelects Trump. If the party looks like it has descended into chaos through the spring and early summer, the idea that it can somehow mystically and magically turn itself around, coalesce behind, you know, Bernie Sanders and then bring independents in and beat Trump,
so
assuming no terrible turn in American fortunes this year. You can't get the presidency like this. That's
maybe I don't necessarily agree. The Republican Party didn't look that great in the summer and spring, or the spring and early summer of 2016.
But it will look better.
There wasn't
than this.
An incumbent on the ballot is the only difference.
But it would have looked better than this. The scenario that I'm laying out is that nobody's the winner.
Right.
Sanders is, you know, is sort of primus inter pares, but nobody's the winner. Going into the convention, he'll probably be the nominee, but you don't really know. You don't know for sure. And Bloomberg is then walking around literally handing out money. I mean, I don't know. He'll be walking around doing this thing in every state saying, I'll give you $100 million if you throw your delegation behind me.
Okay. So this means if Sanders picks Stacey Abrams as his running mate, then Stacey Abrams will be president because Sanders won't last through his first term.
Like physically, right? Like possibly. He will succumb.
Yeah, physically.
Yeah.
Like
or if Bloomberg picks Stacey Abrams,
right?
But that assumes again that either of them can win the nomination after the chaos here, because when the gloves come off and Sanders says, voting for this guy is no different than voting for Trump, which he will say at some point, yeah. It's like you're going to let this is everything that I'm talking about. You have Trump buy the Republican nomination. You're going to have Bloomberg buy the Democratic Party. The country is finished if this happens. Okay? The leader of the delegate count is going to have to say that about the guy who was his rival. And then he'll say, you're a goddamn commie. You know, you honeymooned in the Soviet Union. You said Russia's better than we are. White person is going to want to vote for you, and then he's going to call him a racist, and then and this is going to be the conversation in the Democratic Party from April till July. That's not good for them, I think. But you know what is good for people is the Quip toothbrush. So I want to talk to you guys about our friends at Quip. The makers of the Quip electric toothbrush want you to know the one single discovery that matters for your dental care is that if you have good habits, you are good. That means brushing for 2 minutes twice a day, flossing regularly, no matter what brand you use. Quip makes that simple, starting with an electric toothbrush, refillable floss, and anti-cavity toothpaste. That electric brush has sensitive sonic vibrations with a built-in timer and 30-second pulses to give a full and even clean. The Quip floss dispenser comes with pre-marked string to help you use just enough, which is a big thing. Like, I end up with these immensely long floss strings sometimes, and you can't even get them in the garbage can. It's like they lie on the floor. It's disgusting. Plus, Quip delivers fresh brush head, floss, and toothpaste refills to your door every 3 months with free shipping, so your routine is always right. Join over 3 million healthy mouths and get Quip today, starting at $25. And if you go to getquip.com/commentary right now, you'll get your first refill free. That's your first refill free at getquip.com/commentary. GETQUIP.com/commentary. Quip, the good habits company. Okay, so... let me make one other point about Bloomberg. He ran 3 times for mayor. The first time he barely won because of 9/11, and he barely won over Mark Green. The second time he won quite handily over Bronx Borough President Freddie Ferrer, but he didn't win, he didn't win going away. The third time, after he had this term limits law changed, he spent $150 million in 2009. For his second reelection. Billy Thompson, who was running controller, who was running on the Democratic line, spent $6 million. And the end result, after 8 years of the Bloomberg mayoralty, the wonderful Bloomberg mayoralty that everybody loves so much, Bloomberg got 51% of the vote, and Thompson, who basically ran as a fill-in and had showed very little energy or anything like that, got 46%. Meaning, if Thompson had gone, balls out and really tried to win, he probably could have won. Didn't really go all out. So this again is a question of how Bloomberg is as a candidate for office, which is to say that the more exposure people get to him as a candidate, the less they like him, and he does not wear well. Now, that was 8 years that he didn't wear well, and he changed the law, so people were kind of disgusted by that in some ways, but the notion that he is uniquely strong because of his money is actually kind of disproved by this story. Outspending somebody by $144 million and getting 1% over 50.
As long as we're staying on Bloomberg, I just want to bring up another aspect of this that we haven't talked about yet, which is his online campaign, which is his social media people, those who are running the shop for him on Twitter. So it's all this irreverent, meme-y, snarky, cartoony, weird stuff. And I think what's most interesting about it is how entirely divorced it is from Bloomberg, the guy, and the campaign, precisely because it's easier to try to sell something entirely different than it is to sell him.
Right. Well, that's an interesting thing is,
he's the new Coke.
Yeah. Well, by the way, this is the other thing about this spending, which, as I say, I think, people, if I were a political scientist, I would be spending 20 hours a day on every aspect of the Bloomberg campaign studying it because, nothing like this has ever happened. A person is selling himself to the American people, spending the kind of money to introduce himself as a product that General Mills spends introducing a new cereal, right, or Coke spends selling a new form of Diet Coke. I mean, by the time this is over, he will be spending $1 billion to promote himself personally. No one has ever, this has never happened before in world history. There's nothing like this ever before.
And it's not that it's never been thought of, though.
No one had the money.
When I was back at a journal that does campaigns and elections, like the business end of it, you know, we talked about how modest spending in politics actually was for what is essentially a national PR campaign. Right. Really modest amounts of money that should be many billions of dollars.
Yeah. George Will, who opposed campaign finance reform, would write this column every year saying, we spend more, people spend more to advertise, you know, toothpaste by a factor of 10 right. than they spend choosing the president.
The problem that you encounter when you spend this much money is that you don't get a return on it, which is why it's been self-limited. Because when you think about it, he spent more than Obama in 2012, upwards of $500 million now, for, in national polls, around 15%. Not a lot. I mean, he's good in a field that is fractured along those lines, that he's competitive in at 15%, but it's still only 15%.
Which raises the interesting question, if he had started in March of 2019 and had spent it this low, so he was now, say, at $1 billion as opposed to $500 million, would he be any better off?
But then he would have to compete in the early states where your money advantage is neutralized by the smallness of the territory.
Right, which is why this the interesting attack on Iowa and New Hampshire over the last couple, which everybody has understood as Iowa is a terrible administrator of its own first-in-the-nation position, but there was a theory about why it was good that these states got to go first, which is that it eliminated monetary advantages, that you could run a shoestring campaign in these states because you could do retail politics because they were so small and they were organized in a way that made it possible to do so. So, you know, John McCain saved his campaign when it ran out of money in 2008 by winning in New Hampshire, by basically planting himself there and making himself a sort of beloved figure there. And there, I mean, there are stories about this, you know, dating back to 1976 or whatever. Now we see why that's maybe a good idea, not a bad idea, because you could have had this thing where Biden was the balloon that pricked, and then the air got out of the balloon, and then there were these three candidates basically that came out of these two states, and that would have been a fairly conventional race, right? You would have Bernie, Pete, and Amy with their different kind of appeals, and see where that goes. And now there is this, you know, guy about to spend $1 billion, and the effect that he is going to have is totally unprecedented and confusing, and will not redound to the benefit of the party that wants to win the election, unless he wins somehow, which no one has actually laid out convincingly for me a formula by which he wins, but he wins and then he spends $5 billion against Trump, like literally buys up every commercial from you know, on the airwaves in America from August until November. I mean, which, you know, in theory he could do, I guess. But then you get that question of the law of diminishing returns. Right? Okay. Do we want to get off this or do we want to keep talking about it? Because I could talk about it forever because this is drives me so crazy because he was really not a good mayor. He bought peace and he's bribed everybody everywhere. This is just sort of like a national bribery scandal.
He'd be easier to market as a serial, is what you're saying, as a candidate.
He exists as a running indictment of the Democratic orthodoxy on campaign finance, which is valuable.
That's true.
The only thing I'll say is I think he's going to get creamed on all of this tomorrow night.
Okay, well, then,
I mean, these are.
But then there's Noah's point, which is, look, Super Tuesday is in,
2 weeks.
10 days. It's 2 weeks from today, so there will be two debates between
today. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a debate tomorrow night. There's a debate a week from tomorrow night, I think, in South Carolina. The Nevada caucuses are Saturday, this coming Saturday. The South Carolina primary is a week from Saturday. And then Super Tuesday is 3 days after that. What a terrible schedule. I mean, like, again, how they thought this through. I mean, every time they make these changes to, like, save the party from itself. So now California's in Super Tuesday. So once again, California's completely ignored.
Right.
I mean, it won't be ignored because if Bernie wins California commandingly, let's say, and he is leading by 20 points, according to some polls, if he were to somehow get to 40 or 50% in California, that will be the margin that he will keep with him from there till.
It's a lot, but there's also Massachusetts and Virginia and Texas. There's a lot of big states in play.
Right, but I'm just saying, like, you were once again, you're making it impossible. It's like they can't solve this problem. You're making it impossible for these states to. Now they can make a difference now, but if they make a difference because they are distorted by somebody who bought a lot of commercial time, is that going to be revelatory of where the party should be when it chooses the candidate to go up against Trump? That, you know, sure. This. Oh, by the way, one thing I did want to mention about the Twitter, Bloomberg on Twitter, is. So it's like, boy, that's really great. You know, he knows how to hit Trump. He calls him a clown. He says everybody's laughing at you. But what does that have to do with beating Trump?
Right.
I mean, I can see how that, it's like a sugar high. You read it and you're like, oh, man, he really gave it to him. That's great there. So what voter in Wisconsin changes his vote because Bloomberg issued a disrespectful tweet and then will throw Trump off his game because he really knows how to hit Trump where it hurts? How exactly is hitting Trump where it hurts Trump going to change a voter who would vote for Trump but might not vote for Trump? Because it'll encourage Trump to make mistakes. This is a very complicated play. You're going to vote for somebody because you think that he'll get under the other guy's skin and make him make unforced errors.
The poking the bear technique, yeah, it's not exactly.
It's also not Mike Bloomberg. I mean, it's whatever weirdos are managing his Twitter presence.
Well, but also, you know, where is poking Trump the bear had a positive political effect?
Look where it got Mike Avenatti. <You know?
laughs> I just mean, like, you know, what happened in 2018? Democrats won a landslide victory and took the House. And how did they do it? Because they ran good candidates in a solid campaign in which Trump was the 800-pound gorilla, but they didn't have to, like, they didn't spend the entire campaign talking about how awful Trump was. That was always there, and that was sort of the press's job, was to keep that in the forefront of the minds of the voters. But they ran on healthcare and local issues and stuff like that. Like, you're now presuming that the only thing that the candidate for the Democratic Party should do is, like, make fun of Trump for 3 months. Like, that's stupid. You have to make people like you for yourself and fall in love with you. Like, that's the other thing, is where does it, even the Republican Party sort of fell in love with Romney. Remember, like, there was this moment when Romney, who was really not connecting to anybody, and then it was like, well, there was this girl, her father worked for Bain, and he shut the company down so the entire company could go look for her because she was a runaway, and she went to New York with her boyfriend, and that was so nice, and he did this, and he gives a lot of money to charity, and suddenly was like, oh, man, he's so nice. He's so wonderful. He's a lovely person. Look at his beautiful family. When's that going to happen with Bloomberg? Or Bernie, by the way.
Everything changes after the convention. The bio spot runs on day one, and everybody falls in love, and that's the end.
Yeah.
Or at least they pretend to.
When they show the bio spot of Bernie saying that the Soviet Union has a superior system to the United States, that's really going to be fantastic.
No, it's a shirtless one of him singing Russian folk songs in Moscow. That's going to change.
Exactly. Okay, so let me talk to you guys about NetSuite, okay? Because what do companies like Ring, Hint, and all have in common? They all use NetSuite to accelerate their growth. Successful companies know that in order to grow faster, you must have the right tools. Whether you're doing a million, 10 million, or hundreds of millions in revenue, NetSuite by Oracle gives you the tools you need to accelerate your growth. With NetSuite, you get a full picture of your business, finance, inventory, HR, customers, and more. It's everything you need to grow all in one place, right from your phone or computer. NetSuite will give you the visibility and control you need to make the right decisions and grow with confidence. That's why NetSuite customers grow faster than the S&P 500. NetSuite is the world's number one cloud business system, trusted by more than 19,000 companies. It's the last system you'll ever need. NetSuite, business grows here. Schedule your free product tour right now and receive your free guide, 7 Key Strategies to Grow Your Profits, at netsuite.com/commentary. That's netsuite.com/commentary, netsuite.com/commentary. So one last thing I want to mention in terms of the unknowns that are going to face this presidential season. Apple announced late last night that it was going to miss its first quarter revenue targets because of the uncertainty and economic problems in China caused by the coronavirus. In part, there were other things. The coronavirus is one of these the first real X factor of the Trump presidency that we've been talking about forever, which is how is Trump going to react and respond to Deepwater Horizon or the rise of ISIS, the kids at the border in 2014, these things that afflicted the Obama administration almost every year, these unpredictable world crises that Obama often didn't handle particularly well.
I interrupt briefly because the premise is that he was afflicted by these crises. The reason why they dominated our imagination so much is twofold. One, because he didn't respond to them well. And two, because they wanted them to be big.
Right.
They wanted Deepwater Horizon to be a big world event and made it so.
Okay.
Trump administration has approached these events a little differently. Right. Iran could constitute one of these crises, but it was well managed.
Right. And they are not, in fact, panicking. Interestingly enough, they're not panicking about the coronavirus, though in a weird way, it could play into the trade war, which he seems to want to quiet down. But, I mean, you could play into sort of like anti-migrant sentiment. Look, you can't just have free travel of people all over the place. Like, there's now a worldwide pandemic. We can't let people in and all of that. They're not doing that yet, in part, I think, because the consequences of this are so unpredictable that, you know, you don't want to, not that the Trump administration is particularly heedful of these sorts of things, but that, you know, you don't want to say something that 2 weeks later turns out to be wildly, you know, untrue. But also because the economic consequences are so unpredictable. Like, on the one hand, if China, like, goes through a depression because there's a problem with exporting anything that was touched by Chinese hands or was made in China, that could have a weird sugar high effect on our economy, where because money will come into our economy that was going to go into China. But it could also hurt, you know, American investment in China, which is not an insubstantial part of the economy. Oh, come on.
Oh, okay. I have two things to say. One, on Trump and China, one other thing we should mention is that they have been very good on the Huawei 5G stuff in a way that some of our European allies, unfortunately, have not. The skepticism about whether or not a Chinese company like Huawei is, in fact, building in backdoors for surveillance into its technology is a very important one, and it's one we've taken an extremely conservative position on, which is, don't trust, and it's difficult to verify, so let's not go down that path. The UK recently went the other way, and I think the administration has been very good at trying to show some of the future risks to embracing that sort of model. On the issue of the coronavirus, I just want to give a slight, somewhat feeble defense of Tom Cotton, who's getting a lot of blowback for comments he made over the weekend when he was asked about whether we should trust what China is saying about its handling of the coronavirus. That was the context in which he said, well, you know, we don't, you know, we really can't trust what they say. We can't trust the Chinese state media. I mean, look, there was this, you know, biohazard. There's this bioweapons facility not far from the wet market where they claim the virus started. It was a kind of offhand remark, and he's now being accused of promoting, you know, wild conspiracy theories by the same journalist, I might add, who earnestly listened to every celebrity anti-vaxxer they can possibly give airtime to. So I feel a little bad for Senator Cotton. And I do agree with John that I think the cautious approach so far from the administration has been good.
I mean, speculation is from China watchers has long been that the notion that China will enter some sort of a depression, much less a recession, seems hard to envision, considering that their annual GDP growth is roughly around 7-8%.
And six, I think.
It's six now.
Yeah.
They're forecasting now downward adjustments around six. And people who've been, you know, watched China for a long enough time said, you know, this is its economy is predicated on this kind of growth. A lot of it's construction driven, and it's got to maintain that level of growth to prevent social instability. So we're here. The growth is now contracting, or at least coming into line with a little bit more of the kind of growth you would expect from an economy that is now one of the world's largest economies. So do we see that kind of social instability? I mean, this is the kind of thing that could do it. We have not, outside of Hong Kong, we really have not seen the kind of social instability that you would think would be precipitated by this kind of a crisis where people are literally being locked in. And I mean, the images that you get and the news reports that leak out of Wuhan are really dystopian. It's hard to know what to believe because all of it is you know, leaking out secondhand, and it's not government approved, which is, you know, okay, good, but it's hard to know what to believe. So everybody's smartly reserving judgment, I think, on this thing. But there are notes of real scary dystopian stuff.
Well, Abe, you analogize this to Chernobyl.
Yeah, but it's amazing to me that you know, people like Tom Cotton are actually catching heat for you know, saying we should be cautious. This is just after everyone watched the Chernobyl miniseries and raved about it and said, I didn't. The sort of common response was, I didn't realize how much the Russian government had covered up and lied about this and the machinations they went through. And now everyone's, you know, the same people are now sort of saying, you know, It's racist to judge China too harshly on this, to be too suspicious.
Yeah, and by the way, the official numbers, like, it's amazing. There's a there's a Twitter feed run by a former comedy writer named Steve Luckner, who is a very good, very basic news Twitter feed, and every morning he says, oh, look, the numbers changed. Like, one day the Chinese announced that there are fewer people died.
Right.
Where there are fewer cases, and then there are more, right. Then there are fewer. Like, these numbers are not adding up. The behavior of the Chinese government, on the one hand, is to say that, don't pay. It's Chip Diller going, you know, all is well. You know, don't stampede me here in the streets of Faber College. And on the other hand, they have 50 million people in quarantine. Like, no, there's never been anything like this. Like, entire cities and regions are being, you know, denuded. Hong Kong has canceled school. Kids are not allowed to go to school in Hong Kong. By the way, maybe the interesting problem with the social instability thing is that a pandemic is not a good time for there to be, you know, rampant social instability. Because people are scared that they're going to die. It's not, you know, like, they're not going to go and be in a mass demonstration somewhere where you could, you know, where they're all going to be wearing masks in the mass demonstration.
Yeah, no, one of the problems that they've encountered is feeding people. Now, they have reserves of dry goods and grains for about a year, supposedly. But the logistics of getting people fed in a country that large with that kind of population where productivity has ground to a halt is daunting.
Oh, I'm not saying it couldn't happen in the long term. I'm saying it's not going to happen now, because they're in the middle of it. But, you know, I tend to be a skeptic about the horrifying nature of the disease outbreak. I think we've had five or six of these over the last 20, 30, 40 years, starting with the swine flu at some point, and then moving on to the bird flu and SARS and various other things, and they don't actually turn into, you know, this, you know, the movie Contagion. You know, that doesn't happen. This, from what you read, is the first one that has the real possibility. It's incredibly contagious. It's 15 times more contagious than the average flu.
And, you know, by the way, so to talk about the unforeseeable. So if, God forbid, we start seeing a lot of cases here, there's nothing the Trump administration can do that will satisfy anyone.
Yeah.
Acts, right. And you remember what happened when Chris Christie put the on when Ebola was happening and Chris Christie
the quarantine.
Put the guy in quarantine, and then people started saying he was a fascist. Yeah. But again, Ebola, that was not a serious
threat. Is an Ebola outbreak right now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In Congo, that is as deadly as the 2014 epidemic, right. And nobody seems to care.
Right. Well, because there's no
political relevance.
Right. But on the one hand, you know, my guess is that the Trump administration would be very, you know, it has no ideological hostility towards centralized action of that sort. So it, and particularly if it's, you know, coming from abroad, so it would have no it would probably have no compunction about, you know, mobilizing in that way. And then that's where you get the interesting question. So in a in an election year, would, you know, Democrats like say, you fascist, you're starting concentration camps for people with disease? Meanwhile, we saw what happened on this cruise ship where they quarantined the cruise ship and everybody on the cruise ship got coronavirus. Like, that was really great. But of course, what, sort of what a quarantine is for, I guess.
No, but imagine the conspiracy theories that'll blossom. I mean, there'll be plenty on the right, but the ones on the left will be very much like, oh, the deliberately smallpox-infested blanket sent to the Native American style of, you know, whomever the Trump administration is going to target for quarantine is going to be seen as, you know, Trump's latest victims, more people in cages. And the panic that will unfortunately dominate will be.
Yeah, but again, that's where you have that this has all kinds of unpredictable, you know, aspects. And if you think that Bloomberg wouldn't say something stupid and counterproductive, he has a particular facility for doing that at times of, as long as he personally is not experiencing some inconvenience or hazard, which of course is very hard for him to experience since he has $61 billion and thus doesn't have to ever experience
any
hazard.
Well, you know, on the matter of China, he said that Beijing is responsive to the Chinese people.
Yeah, he loves Xi. He loves the Chinese because, you know, that's what he.
Speaking of that hospital that they built in like a week, is apparently a piece of garbage. It's like falling apart. The images from it, it's just like decrepit. There's water coming through the ceilings, and they can't fill the beds. They can't fill these places, not because they don't have enough sick people, but because they're going to other places, the more local shelters, and, you know, just dying in their house, or like the local mall that has now become a triage center. Like, it's just, you know, very communist.
Yeah, and the thing is that we're not going to know what's going. You know, for a amazingly free economy that is, you know, just charging ahead and blah blah blah. Liberty is, you know, free markets lead to free governments and all of this. Like, the control of information there is really astounding. Like, it's astonishing how little we know about what's going on in Wuhan. Like, it's beyond belief that you could that this is Chernobyl level. And Chernobyl was 1986 when there was no, you know, when they literally could tamp down an entire country or an entire region, and there, you know, because there weren't even roads or train lines in and out. So anyway, that's fun. So we will. Noah will not be here on Thursday, alas, as he is. He will be elsewhere. But we will, through the ministrations of our friends at Ricochet, be doing an all Skype show after the Nevada primary, and we will give you our reactions and responses then. So for Noah Rothman, Abe Greenwald, and Christine Rosen, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.